Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Currently, there are 10 states in the United States reporting large fires. So far this year, more than 4.5 million acres have been affected. This morning, in this part of the show, we'll be talking about some of the ways that nature and also human activity contribute to the increased risk of large, intense fires. And our guest for the program is Stephen Pine from Arizona State University. He is interested in his research on the ways that people and nature interact, and particularly is interested in the history, ecology, and management of fire. He has authored a number of books on this subject. Let me just name a couple of the recent ones that have to do with wildfire in the United States. From 2004, Tending Fire, Coping with America's Wildland Fires, Smoke Chasing from 2003, Fire, A Brief History from 2001, also Year of the Fires, The Story of the Great Fires of 1910, that was published in 2001. He's also written fire histories of both Australia and Canada. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. We'll be talking a bit about wildfires in the U.S. and perhaps review some of the controversy surrounding both the prevention and fighting of wildfires. And questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. We ask just that people are brief in their comments so we can get in as many callers as possible, keep the program moving. Anyone's, though, welcome to call with a question. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you might be listening. Around the two-state area here, well, more than two states, I suppose, where the signal will travel. Also for people listening on the Internet, you may also use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILO or 9455 for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Payne, hello. Or
hi.
Pine, I should say. Pardon me. Glad to be with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Just to review the numbers a little bit, as I said, and now I'm looking here at statistics, numbers that come from the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, talking about where the big fires are. There are now 10 states, and they're all in the West, no surprise, reporting big fires. The leaders are Idaho with 15 and Montana with 13. And then there are also fires in California, Florida, Nevada, North Dakota, Oregon, South Dakota, Utah, Washington, Wyoming. Florida is the only place in the eastern United States.
Right.
And that so far this year to date, the statistics here, over 4.5 million acres affected. And that puts it ahead of the 10-year average, which is something over 3.1 million. It also looks like the last few years, this year, 2006, 2005, 2004 were particularly bad. At least they're over the 10-year average. Is there something that has been going on over the last few years that has contributed to increased acreage affected?
Sure. Well, there are several things. One thing is, for about the last 20 years, the West in particular has been subject to a drought, some years flaring up worse than others. And that's created a disposition for large fires, which was not true in the decade or so before this cycle started. The other thing is changes in how we manage fire. That is, changes in practices and policies. For 30 to 40 years now, among the federal agencies, there has been a drive to reintroduce fire, to get more burned area on the ground. And in a perverse sort of way, we're seeing the results of that. Mm. In other words, not all of these burned areas are considered detrimental. The agencies have struggled mightily to try to reintroduce fire. And some of this is deliberate and some of this is indirect. They're much more inclined now to back off rather than try to hit a fire in rugged terrain, give it a valley to burn out, move a ridge or two away, let fire do some of its ecological work, try to reduce costs, improve firefighter safety. So we're seeing some of these numbers are actually the result of changes in how we're fighting fires.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can definitely tell if you look at the map, you can see where the fires are, that they cluster, aside from that, the one that I mentioned in Florida, they're definitely clustered in a particular area. And as I said, most of them in Montana and in Idaho, and they're certainly all in the western part of the United States, in that one area. And I don't know if this is an obvious question or the answer is obvious or not, but that is, why is it that these big wildfires are a western phenomenon? We just don't, historically, we have had some east of the Mississippi, but for a long, long time now, it seems that this is pretty much a western phenomenon.
Right. Well, there are two reasons. One is the natural background or basis for fire is a pattern of wetting and drying. And the reason you don't see regular large fires in the Northeast, the Ohio Valley, and so forth, is that you don't have an annual dry season.
Hmm.
You don't have that period where things can be ready to burn. Occasionally some kind of drought, but basically, if fire is going to happen, people create the conditions to put fire in. In the West, you have an ideal setup for natural fire. But the other reason is that the geography of fire pretty much corresponds, and this holds true for most of the Florida scene as well, to public land. We actually have a map of forest fires for the 1880 census. It's quite interesting because most of the fire is in the Northeast. The greatest proportion of fire is actually where it's always been, that is in the southeastern portion of the U.S., and that's still where it remains today. But the fire problem since 1880 has moved to the public lands. On private lands, we've found ways to replace fire as a tool for any number of reasons. We've suppressed it. We've eliminated it. It's pretty rare. But by creating public lands, we've created a sort of permanent habitat for fire, particularly in the West, where the natural geographic conditions favor it.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose one thing we just might mention in terms of natural causes for fire, the one thing that the West, that you see in the West that you pretty much don't see in the East is dry lightning. Here in our part of the country, if there's lightning, there's going to be a thunderstorm. And
yeah.
So that tends to work against fire. But in the West, you see something very different. And a lot of the fires that are touched off naturally are touched off by that.
That's right, and it's fairly common. It's routine. Where I live in Arizona, it's very frequent to have dust storms early in the season. What happens is that all the moisture evaporates before it reaches the ground, so the winds continue. They pick up lots of dust and scatter it. Well, they would scatter flames if flames were on the ground. But what isn't bothered by that is lightning. It makes its way all the way to the ground. So, you have this sort of dissociation of wetting and drying, where the lightning is occurring is not necessarily where the rain is falling. And that's, given something, you know, to strike and given the right conditions, that can be very effective. You don't see that really in the East, certainly not in the Northeast,
mm-hmm.
Occasionally a little in the Southeast and so forth. But the other reason why these lightning fires are now so prominent they drive the system is because we have removed people from those landscapes. They are, by choice, by political deliberation, uninhabited. So in the past, people would have put their own fires in, and you would have had a competition of burning between the two. It would have changed the time of season, perhaps the amount burned, and so forth. But by removing people, for the most part, we've left only lightning to do the work, and so lightning drives the statistics now.
Hmm. Well, how is it possible to say of recent big fires, how many of them did have human origin and might have been caused either intentionally, so they might have been a result of arson, or it might simply have been an accident, but one way or another, they were human-caused?
Well, in the past, the largest proportion of important fires were all human-caused. And this is because they were associated with other kinds of land use changes, logging, clearing for settlement, other kinds of activities. People would have used fire for everything. And again, that sort of overwhelmed the lightning statistics. And now, because we've tended to eliminate those causes, lightning has become more prominent. But if you break it down, you'll find that a significant fraction of the important and damaging fires are still the result of people. Here in the Southwest, the largest fires over the last century in Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado, for example, were all started by people. And in fact, what's really eerie is that they were all started by people associated with the fire community. So one in Arizona was set by the rodeo fire by an Apache Indian who was wanted to be hired to help fight it. New Mexico was set by a National Park Service crew that was conducting a prescribed burn that blew up, burned into Los Alamos. Colorado by a fire prevention technician with the Forest Service who started the fire for reasons that still seem to be inexplicable. Mm-hmm. So the story is really one of interaction between natural conditions and sort of human behavior. There's a real tendency, particularly in recent years, to attribute it all to climate, that there's nothing you can do, this is simply climate. But climate is only, the weather is only creating preconditions, and many of these are the result of people. And even when lightning starts fires, how we respond to those fires will determine what kinds of fires result.
Let me introduce again our guest, Stephen Pine. He is Regents Professor in the Human Dimensions Faculty at Arizona State University School of Life Sciences and has written a lot about the history of wildfire in this country and others, and has a number of books on the subject. And if you're interested in reading in this area, you should head down to the bookstore or the library. His name, by the way, is spelled with a Y, if you go looking. So that's P-Y-N-E, not like the tree. You will find a number of his books. The most recent is The Still Burning Bush. I'm assuming, is that an update of the book about Australia?
Yes, it was. I had a chance to go to Australia on a fellowship for a month and then looked at the scene. It's really quite interesting.
Is it is Australia in some significant respects, with this subject we're talking about, is it much like the United States?
It's much like the United States, but Australia made, after World War II in particular, some very interesting choices that changed its direction. The great thing about Australia is the endurance of what they call the fire stick, that is to say the human torch, the capacity of people to put fire in the land. And you can track it from Aboriginal occupation through early settlers in rural Australia. What's fascinating is that foresters, and this was the only country where state-sponsored forestry did this, adopted controlled burning as a means, as a primary means, to manage forests and fires, that they thought they could, by adapting these old practices, keep fire at bay. And it's a fascinating story because it's sort of the road not taken in the U.S. We went through that debate, chose the other side that we would try to extinguish fires. Australia decided for a number of reasons, not least of which that they didn't want to follow the American model, that they would provide their own alternative. And what's interesting is that essentially the environmentalist movement in Australia and the urban-based culture of Australia, and it is a heavily urban society, have hated that and have wanted, in effect, to reintroduce suppression, to eliminate fire from the landscape, eliminate that heritage. At exactly the same time, the United States is desperately trying to get fire back in.
Well, perhaps we could talk a little bit about that history here in the United States and about how, for such a long time, the main idea was to prevent fires, to fight fires, and that for the Forest Service, I think for a long time, that was their reason to be. And all of this really can be traced back to one period in American history, and this is also another thing that you've written about, and that is 1910, this year where we had an enormous number of big fires that made a big impression on people, and for a long time that was the thing that that shaped, that influenced the policy, the wildfire policy that we had here in this country.
Well, that's certainly true. You know, not to go academic on you a minute, but foresters who were doing this, who had assumed control over these large public lands, these reserves, were really part of a global project, and they were looking to the French and British in particular, looking to British India of all places, for inspiration and models. And foresters, all of them, were obsessed with fire and believed that until they could control fire, nothing else they could do in the land would matter. And the U.S. Forest Service was only 5 years old, actually less than 5 years old in 1910. Its charismatic chief, Gifford Pinchot, had been fired earlier in the year for insubordination. So it felt itself under political attack, and then it got hammered by these large fires, which were not simply big in area, but the timing was right. The politics of it was very polarizing. They felt challenged. They lost 78 firefighters in one afternoon in six different incidents. They were plunged into almost $1 million of debt, which was real money in 1910. The agency mm-hmm. could have simply been gutted had Congress not made up the difference. So it was a real political challenge and crisis, and it affected an entire generation. This was a young group, homogeneous group, and it is not until that entire generation passes from the scene that they will accept any other alternative to fire than to sort of fight it to the death. Hmm. So that begins the story, in a sense, in a huge way, that instead of having a give and take, an ongoing discussion about how much fire might be appropriate, how we put fire in, how we take it out, there was just sort of this huge buildup. We are going to crush fire. And with the resources that the Roosevelt administration made available during the New Deal, it seemed possible. And they announced, in 1935, the chief announced what was called the 10 a.m. policy, that there would be one universal standard across the country in all places that you would suppress the fire by 10 o'clock the morning following its report. And if you failed, then you would plan to do it by 10 o'clock the next day and so on. And so this was sort of the high water mark. And then World War II removes a lot of the resources, but sort of reinvigorates the sense that we're at war with fire. And this continues until the 1960s. And since then, the National Park Service first and then the Forest Service about a decade later have tried to reverse that policy and find ways to put fire back in, recognizing that all we'd done was create a kind of ecological insurgency, which didn't seem to be ending in any way we could manage. And we were doing a lot of ecological damage from fire. And so for almost 40 years now for the Park Service, 30 years for the Forest Service, the policy has changed. And yet we still see this debate dressed up in a Smokey Bear costume as though the choice is between this old suppression policy or a new policy. The choice is really within the new policy. How do we put fire back in? At what cost? By what techniques? What trade-offs are going to be involved? That's really the public debate that needs to take place. But we continue to, as I say, dress it up in Smokey Bear and trot Smokey out that the choice is between suppression or reintroducing fire. That debate was solved a long time ago, and it's time we accepted that.
Mm-hmm. Well, why is it, though, that debate continues? And I don't know if it was you or somebody else I've talked about, that we still seem to be having this public debate about wildfires. Is you either got to fight them or light them, one or the other, and that's not really the right kind of approach. And yet somehow that is still the way that we talk about it. I mean, why yep. is that the case?
Well, we just like to polarize, and it can be in certain political circumstances. These positions then become allied with other polarizing forces. And it makes it very difficult. And this is what happened in 1910. It got, the choice was you either do one or the other, and there's no other alternative. Well, there are lots and lots of alternatives. There are many things you can do. And you really need to be pragmatic and break these topics down into units and analyze what's going on. I still think Smokey Bear is such a powerful, well-known figure that it's convenient for all parties to sort of drag him out when that's really not what the subject's about anymore. And it's time we moved on. And my sense is that the public does understand that fire has a place, much like wolves or grizzly bears. They just don't want it in their backyard, which is very reasonable. And I think they can rightly be confused about the terminology and what's going on and these funny statistics that here we are, we're above the 10-year average. Well, in one sense, we've been trying to get above the 10-year average for 30 or 40 years now. So let's break this down into meaningful numbers that tell us something. And how much of this is attributable to the way we're fighting fires, the way we're granting more room for fires? Let's separate those kinds of fires from the issue of houses burning along an urban fringe. They tend to get lumped together and hyped in ways that are really not very helpful.
Well, how does that, I think one of the things that does indeed complicate your fire management policy is the fact that now we have more people who are living in and around the areas that we're talking about. And it's still going to be a problem. If there's nobody there, it's going maybe indeed be a problem, and it might be a difficult decision deciding what it is you're going to do. But if we have somebody's house there, that creates a whole different kind of discussion. Does the fact that there are more people who have said, I want to live in wild areas, and we have people in them and near them, how has that made the whole business of deciding how it is we want to deal with fire more difficult?
Well, it certainly complicates it, not simply from the direct threat of fire to the houses, but also from smoke and other sorts of spill-off issues that affect sort of the whole quality of life in these circumstances. I mean, my take is that for some time now we have been recolonizing what was formerly rural America, but we're doing it with an urban outmigration. And this sprawl, it's even beyond sprawl, is interbreeding with whatever hazard is out there. So fire is a particularly dramatic one, and it seems silly. But think about floodplains. Think about coastal construction. Think about earthquake zones. I mean, we're doing it everywhere. And fire, in some ways, is pretty far down the list. It's pretty dramatic, but in terms of actual damages, it doesn't come anywhere near wind and water. One Category 4 hurricane will do more damage than a century of fires. Nonetheless, it does complicate the picture, but we need to sort of parse that issue away from many other issues, which is not being done, I think, as well as it should. We can keep houses from burning. We know that. We know how to do that. We know that the biggest issue is roofing, combustible roofing, far and away. And the next issue is having stuff that can communicate flame directly from the ground or shrubs to a combustible house, to a porch, to steps, to a siding. And this is what's doing it. And as Australians have discovered in their studies, a lot of it are simply what they call ember attacks. It's just these showers of sparks that descend on houses. And if there's stuff to burn, the house will burn. And it will also burn unless there is somebody there to fight it. So part of the odd thing that's going on is that we've removed people. We're having these mass evacuations, so there's nobody there to take out the one spark that might burn down a house. Mm. Again, the Australians are way ahead of us on this. You know, their approach is that almost all the fatalities in these fires, the really dangerous thing, are these last-minute evacuations. So the people are confused, it's smoky. Fires are very loud and disorienting. And then people run back. They forget something, a pet or something, and run back, and that's when they get killed. The car runs off the road. These kinds of things. So you either leave early or you stay in the house. And if you're going to stay, there are certain things you can do to protect yourself in the house. And it sounds counterintuitive because what we see are images of sort of tsunamis of flame racing through, but that's not how these houses are being taken out. And the other thing is, next time you look at an aerial view of one of these, look at the difference between houses which have incinerated completely and there's nothing left but the foundation, and all the trees that are around it. And the trees are generally standing. The only scorching from the trees came from the burning house. So we're not even using the knowledge that we do have to handle these fires very well. There's a lot we can do to sort of let the local people be responsible if that's what we want. But right now we sort of take everybody out and then we decide, well, we can't put firefighters at risk. So there's nothing. So one spark can do it.
Well, I think
that's one set of problems. But those have technical issues. What to do, say, in wilderness or this generic wildland, public land stuff in the West, those are much harder issues because they're cultural decisions. And there really is little agreement on what we want that land to be and what kind of fire would be appropriate.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Stephen Pine. He is Regents Professor in the Human Dimensions Faculty at Arizona State University School of Life Sciences. He is particularly interested in his work on the interaction of people and the environment, and a particular focus for him has been fire, management of fire. He has written a number of books about fire in the United States. They include Tending Fire, Coping with America's Wildland Fires from 2004, also Year of the Fires, The Story of the Great Fires of 1910, that book that would explain something about how it is that we came, at least what was the prevailing idea about dealing with fires, how that came to be for such a long time. His most recent book is The Still Burning Bush, and that is an update of an earlier book that he wrote about fire history in Australia. He's also written about fire history in Canada, and you can look for his books at the library or the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at them. Questions are welcome. We do have a couple of people here ready to go. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. First up, we have someone in the community of Belgium, line number 4, right here. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to point out that in pre-Columbian history, the native peoples of at least the eastern United States would literally set fires to protect themselves. It also made it easier for them to live. They could see who was coming and stuff because they burn out a lot of the underbrush and stuff. Now, obviously, we really can't do that every place. But why don't we do something like that a bit more? You know, they modify their own surroundings to their own advantage.
I mean, that's a great question. It's a great point. In fact, not just in the eastern United States or in the western United States, but everywhere you want to go, people have always used fire to make their world habitable. And it's only a more recent industrial societies that have sought to eliminate that. There are a number of ways to protect yourself. You don't have to burn. I mean, you can do various kinds of thinning and mowing. You can do certain kinds of landscaping that can be very attractive. You don't have to nuke the landscape to protect, say, a structure. But you can sculpt it in a way that can be aesthetically pleasing and yet still provide considerable fire protection. We haven't gone far enough in thinking carefully about this. Your argument, however, that in pre-Columbian times people burned, we ought to be doing that. That is, in fact, behind much of the thinking that we need to restore fire. The complicating factor in the Western lands is the whole wilderness concept that somehow the native peoples were trivial in their effects and can be disregarded, that history could be disregarded, and the only kind of fire we should allow or introduce is naturally caused fire. My sense is that people have always been a part of it. It's been an interaction of the two, and that many of these landscapes that we thought we were protecting turn out to have been cultural landscapes in some ways, and they were shaped by regular patterns of human burning, and that if we really want to reinstate those kinds of landscapes or recapture the processes that made them possible, then we'll have to do the burning ourselves. If you do that, then you get into legal questions of liability. Somebody is now culpable. Somebody started it. Somebody's responsible. Whereas if you turn it over to lightning, in a sense, you've outsourced the issue to nature and have sidestepped a lot of those concerns.
The unfortunate part about waiting for Mother Nature to do it, it'll be a much larger fire and way beyond our control.
That's right, and it may not produce the results you think. And right now, turning it over to nature, after 100 or 150 years of profound disturbances, you're not getting the same effect you would have had lightning set a fire in 1870.
Thank you very much.
Right, thanks for the call. Well, just for a moment here, because I am sure that people would say that they had heard stories about prescribed burns that got out of control and that led to much bigger fires. Is it difficult, technically speaking, is it difficult to do that and to have it be limited to the extent that you want it to be limited and not have that get away from you?
Well, you're going to have escapes, just as we have escapes now when we try all-out suppression. But there have been some spectacular failures, the fire that burned into Los Alamos in 2000 probably being the best known, but the National Park Service the day before had lit a fire in the North Rim of Grand Canyon, which blew up on them. You'd think they would have learned from this and forced the evacuation of the North Rim. That burned to the Canyon Rim. It was a rather large fire. And there have been others. And there were issues then with smoke. Smoke drifts across highways. If there's a traffic accident, who is responsible for that? It suddenly becomes quite complicated. And I think it's part of the what had not seemed clear when the revolution started in the 60s was just how difficult it would be to put fire back in. Once you've taken it out, it's very hard to reinstate it. And it's turned out to be expensive, complicated. In some cases, we may need to manipulate the landscape. You may need to send in chainsaws, then do some woody weeding, rearranging so that you get the fires you want. And I think where the values are very high, and I think the biological or ecological values are high, then you need to have fire back in, and it's worth the cost. But if all you're doing is reducing fuels, then you may be told simply use wood chippers or burn it off in a biomass conversion plant or something else.
Let's talk with someone else down in southern Illinois, line number one. Hello.
Hi, thank you. I have two fire questions, but first, because your guest is from Arizona, I wanted to know, I think it was last week, there was on the news one day just a huge dust storm over Phoenix. What caused that? What happened to it? How did it impact Phoenix?
Sure. Well, that's easy. This is the time of year when we get these storms. It's referred to as our monsoon or sometimes Mexican monsoon season. We get moisture coming from the south. They develop enormous thunderstorms. This is exactly the same season and the same mechanism that gives us our dry lightning in the mountains. So that is the time of sort of naturally caused big fires.
And this is a dust storm.
Well, if you're in the mountains, you're not getting dust. But if there are flames on the ground, then they will act on it. So what you get is basically a thunderstorm without the rains.
Mm-hmm.
And the moisture comes down, the wind comes down very high, spilling out on all sides, and it picks up whatever loose material is there. And on the outskirts of Phoenix, there's going to be a lot of dust. So you have these sort of massive wind dust storms coming through. Unfortunately, my particular neighborhood has managed to miss. We've had 3 days of rain now and managed to miss it all. All we've had are dust.
Those dust storms are common. It looked huge. It was just amazing.
Well, they've always been around. I think part of it is simply there's aroused public interest in these kinds of effects. Yeah, they are quite large. And imagine, as I suggest, you had that same mechanism, but say relocated to the mountains or foothills,
mm-hmm.
and there was fire in the ground. And in this case,
powerful.
It would just be driving it.
One
quick aside that you might find interesting is that really large fires can create, under the right circumstances, a very powerful convective column. And the dynamic of this is very similar to a thunderstorm. And at the top of this, they may actually evolve into cumulus clouds. So it's called a pyrocumulus. And then when that collapses and the winds rush down from it, again, there's no moisture in the system. What you get are these extremely powerful winds. And we have had several fires, one large one, last summer in the southwest, where this seemed to be the driving mechanism, that in effect the fire had created a circumstance where in effect it generated the equivalent of a thunderstorm, and those downdrafts then just blew the fire right through a rather large patch of forest.
That's wild. My other two questions, I have friends in Salt Lake, and I know central Utah had a large fire, still does, I think. What is burning there? Is it pines? Is it scrub? Is it variety of...
It's a mixture. Again, you've got a lot of terrain difference here. So you've got lower deserty areas, particularly towards Nevada, and then they thicken into various kinds of grasses and brush, then into a pinyon juniper, so-called dwarf forest.
Well,
and then as they move up, they thicken into more forest. So you're getting a mixture of them.
They can smell it up in Salt Lake.
Yes.
And my last question was, when they're fighting the fires and they're dropping this, is it chemicals and water, or what are they using to put it out from the air?
They're using different kinds of retardants. In the West, the most widely used one is a diammonium phosphate. It's actually an agricultural fertilizer with some thickening agents, some color, and some other materials. But the salts in it inhibit combustion. Now, it only works on the surface, so unless you're in grass or something, it won't put the fire out, but it will knock it down. It's somewhat like flame-proof clothing in that it will still smolder, but it won't flame.
And
it just upsets the chemistry.
Does that impact the environment in any positive or negative way?
Well, it's a fertilizer. So the residue, it can add to the ash and in some ways can enhance it. But if there are rivers, creeks, ponds, that will accept the wash off, and that can lead to toxic effects and eutrophication of the water courses. Hmm. So there are trade-offs in the use of it.
Well, thank you, Mr. Pine.
All right. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Stephen Pine. He is professor at Arizona State University, has written a lot about the history of wildfire and the management of wildfire in the United States and also Australia, Canada. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think we were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that for people who do choose to live in fire-prone areas, it's certainly recommended that they do everything they can to reduce fire on their own property, or at least to try to create a zone around their home where they're going to reduce combustible materials. And I think that people both maybe are a little bit resistant to do that, because the reason they move to a place like that is because they want trees.
Sure.
And they don't want to cut them down. And also there may be some expense, I suppose. And also, I think sometimes people have said they're a little bit unclear on what exactly different kinds of regulations there might be about what it is actually they can and can't do. Is that a problem? Is it difficult for a homeowner, for example, to know what it is they may or may not do in terms of their own property?
Yes, it certainly can be, and part of the complications as well are that many of these exurban developments are really in counties, they're not in municipalities, and the regulations are unclear. They're in a kind of ambiguous political zone. For some people, that makes them attractive, but it also makes it difficult to establish and enforce some kind of fire code. The other complication is, I think people are getting very mixed and confusing messages about what really matters in protecting the house. The house itself, the combustibility of the house is the first and highest issue. Beyond that, it's really preventing fires from being able to creep up, literally just creep along the ground and reach a house. So, you know, having a stone walkway around it might be enough to prevent that. The issue tends to focus on trees, particularly larger trees, and we ought to be clear that fire is really driven by small particles. You know, if you have a fireplace or a campfire, you don't throw in to that a large chunk of green wood. The fire goes out. What you want are needles, leaves, grasses, dry twigs, small stuff. That's why you go through the process of kindling and so forth. And that's really what matters. So it's not the big trees necessarily that are an issue. There's sort of confusion or misdirection as to what really matters in protecting it. And so I think in many cases there's a false choice being presented that you have to eliminate these larger more majestic or interesting trees, and in the name of protecting your house, when in fact they may have nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. The house is probably a bigger threat to many of these trees than the trees to the house. We're seeing this over and over again.
Is it then, if you take a look at the landscape on a larger scale, is it feasible to think about mechanically removing the fuel buildup, that is the combustible stuff that's out there, in some way other than burning it? Is that something that is that's at all feasible, or is it just something that when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of acres, you simply can't do it?
Well, you're not going to be able to do it on that scale, and there's going to be no political will to do it on that scale unless there is a real ecological payoff. Say there's an endangered species that for this chunk of land has to have a certain kind of fire, and so you're obligated now to do what is necessary to make that fire happen or prevent it. Otherwise, you're going to need a market. And this gets us back into the wilderness argument, that if you're going to have some kind of market for small wood or little debris, you're going to have long-term contracts and access so that you can afford to capitalize, say, a biomass energy plant to burn it off, or to provide the labor force to wood chip and do something with the wood chipping. And that looks like you've reintroduced a kind of wood product industry into an area that people thought was now out of it. So that raises all kinds of other issues.
We have another caller to bring in here, someone where we are in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if I've missed it. Do you refer to the climate change at all in this discussion? Because it seems to me that trying to maintain the existing, you know, ecosystem with all this expense and money, lives, et cetera, in fighting the fires, this stasis kind of attitude is going to be a problem in the sense that we know there are going to be transformations in the forest. You know, it's regrettable. It's tragic. I try not to break up, but changing the small fires that would allow more appropriate, you know, cover to grow back over a period of, you know, and sort of being the seedbed for the transformation that's going to happen, seems like an important factor. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, that's a great point, and it's another one of the massive uncertainties in deciding what we should do, what is appropriate. For the most part, we've tried to look back to the past and said, well, we can see that the shockwave of settlement set into motion a series of disturbances that have really created an environment we don't really like. We're getting the wrong kind of fires. We'd like to put it back to the way it was, knowing that we can't go exactly back, but recreate something of that landscape, because that seemed to be when it worked. But depending how climate change plays out, that may not be a suitable norm, which leaves us uncertain as to what exactly we do want. What is the end result here? Do we just want a resilient landscape? If so, what does that mean? What about all the invasive species, some of which are extremely fire-prone, all the bromus grasses in the West, for example, that are going to be liberated by large fires, and we may not be able to eradicate them later. So a whole new range of uncertainty is coming into the picture, and it's not clear what we should do. So one side would favor simply letting nature take its course, and whatever comes, it will be cheaper and safer in the long run and absolve us from making more silly mistakes. Another group said, well, we really do value some of these species. We really do like old-growth ponderosa pine. We really do want flammulated owls. We want these other things, and we need to take some steps to make sure they're not simply incinerated. And again, these are cultural calls. They're going to be decided in the political arena, and there's no technical solution to these, as there is, in a sense, a technical solution to the house burning issue.
Let us go to another caller here. We just have about 3-4 minutes left. Let's go to Crete next, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, you mentioned fireproofing the roof and putting a walkway around the house. Is there any handbook or guide to protecting your house that the government or Arizona State University puts out regarding homeowners and what they can do to protect themselves?
Yes, there is. And in fact, to their credit, the agencies, the federal agencies, the state foresters, even the National Fire Protection Association, early on recognized these issues and has produced a whole slew of guidebooks, and you can get them really by region. What I don't think they have done well is integrating in the aesthetic component. They tend to be a bit sort of mechanical engineering approach. Let's look at the heat flux and so forth and protecting it where you could have a more benign landscaping. Again, you don't have to pave this area to protect the house. And even if you did pave around the house, embers are going to come. So there's still more to learn about it, but there are lots of options, and probably the state foresters or the FireWise program or Canada, the FireSmart program, Australia has a community fire guards program, all these things you can download on the web, and they will provide lots of guidelines.
Thank you.
All right. To another caller here, someone on cell phone. This is line 2. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if you've looked into the practices they're doing at Yellowstone. I've been visiting there since 1947 and been there recently. Going out again this year, they've had big fires there. But when you visit the fire areas, the forest is regrowing. It, of course, takes years, and if your cabin were out there, you don't have cabins out in the middle of the forest in Yellowstone, but that would be so fun. But the forest regenerates in a marvelous way and comes back, and it's been doing so for eons of lightning strikes. I don't know if you've studied what happens. There are certain kinds of pines that need fire in order to open their seeds, and others may not, but the forest certainly comes back in a magnificent way.
Well, it comes back in a mixed way, and I think Yellowstone is in some ways a success story. In terms of in that it has advertised the ecological power of fire. My quarrel with Yellowstone in the 1988 fires is that I don't think the debate really that needed to happen happened. Instead, the discussion became whether fire belongs in Yellowstone, whether the ecosystem can tolerate high-intensity fires, whether the park was being irresponsible and simply letting so many of these fires become so large. That, to my mind, was not really the issue. The issue was, how do you do it? How do we reintroduce fire? We spent between 130 and 300 million, nobody seems to know, mucking around with those fires. Is that really the way to do it? Why did the only large fires occur in Yellowstone when the rest of the region had the same set of circumstances and didn't experience these kinds of outbursts? What's the right way to do it? And instead, I think those issues do matter, not simply that large chunks of the forest will come back. Basically, you burned off in 1 year at Yellowstone what would have burned off over 100 years, which is the duration of protection the park had enjoyed. Did that scale matter? I don't know. But my disappointment and my criticism of those fires is that the debate got shifted in ways that I think were unhelpful.
Just very quickly, we talked a little bit earlier about the difference between the United States and Australia. The United States, for a lot of the 20th century, the priority was suppression. And now in recent decades, there has been this effort to reintroduce fire to its place. The Australians, she said, took the opposite approach. For a long time, their priority, well, at least they acknowledged the fact that fire did have a place. Although recently now, apparently, there are people in Australia who are arguing for more suppression. What's been the experience in Canada? Have they approached it at all differently than either the United States or Australia?
They have indeed approached it differently, and Canada is a fascinating story. But they've gone a different route. The Canadian story has been one really of techniques rather than philosophy. A commonality of foresters, an interest in removing fire, very much a commercially driven approach, very much a kind of engineering approach, one which has not really sought at the operating level to engage these kinds of larger cultural issues that have been so important in Australia and the United States. And one of the major reasons for that is that up till 1930, Canada had a system of forest reserves very much like the U.S. Forest Service, in fact, modeled on it, and there were exchanges of people. In 1930, all those lands in the West were ceded to the provinces. So the federal government of Canada no longer had a large public domain or crown lands to oversee. All it had was Parks Canada, which has been very innovative in the last decade, but fairly small. So the ability to float the discussion beyond revenue and firefighting and more efficient technologies has not had the political context in Canada that it has elsewhere, and simply hasn't occurred. Mm.
There, we're going to have to stop. For people who would like to read more on these subjects, again, I suggest you go down to the bookstore, the library, and look for some of the books by our guest, Stephen Pyne, P-Y-N-E. He's written about fire and the history of fire in the world, in the United States, in Australia, in Canada. He is a Regents Professor in the Human Dimensions Faculty at Arizona State University School of Life Sciences. Professor Pyne, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.